mountain rising almost to 1,000 feet, and here and there falling again to low clefts or passes leading into the eastern land beyond. Along the crest of the ridge the hobbits could see what looked to be the remains of green-grown walls and dikes, and in the clefts there still stood the ruins of old works of stone. By night they had reached the feet of the westward slopes, and there they camped. It was the night of the 5th of October, and they were 6 days out from Bree. In the morning they found, for the first time since they had left the Chetwood, a track plain to see. They turned right and followed it southwards. It ran cunningly, taking a line that seemed chosen so as to keep as much hidden as possible from the view, both of the hilltops above and of the flats to the west. It dived into dells and hugged steep banks, and where it passed over flatter and more open ground on either side of it, there were lines of large boulders and hewn stones that screened the travellers almost like a hedge. "I wonder who made this path, and what for?" said Merry, as they walked along one of these avenues, where the stones were unusually large and closely set. "I'm not sure that I like it. It has a, well, rather a barrow whitish look. Is there any barrow on Weathertop?"
"No, there's no barrow on Weathertop, nor on any of these hills," answered Strider. "The men of the West did not live here, though in their later days they defended the hills for a while against the evil that came out of Angmar. This path was made to serve the forts along the walls. But long before, in the first days of the North Kingdom, they built a great watchtower on Weathertop. Armonsul, they called it. It was burned and broken, and nothing remains of it now but a tumbled ring, like a rough crown on the old hill's head. Yet once it was tall and fair. It is told that Elendil stood there watching for the coming of Gil-galad out of the west, in the days of the last alliance." The hobbits gazed at Strider. It seemed that he was learned in old lore, as well as in the ways of the wild.
"Who was Gil-galad?" asked Merry.
But Strider did not answer, and seemed to be lost in thought. Suddenly a low voice murmured, "Gil-galad was an elven king, of him the harpers sadly sing, the last whose realm was fair and free between the mountains and the sea. His sword was long, his lance was keen, his shining helm afar was seen, the countless stars of heaven's field were mirrored in his silver shield. But long ago he rode away, and where he dwelleth none can say, for into darkness fell his star in Mordor, where the shadows are."
The others turned in amazement, for the voice was Sam's.
"Don't stop," said Merry. "That's all I know," stammered Sam, blushing. "I learned it from Mr. Bilbo when I was a lad.
He used to tell me tales like that, knowing how I was always one for hearing about elves. It was Mr. Bilbo as taught me my letters.
He was mighty book-learned, was dear old Mr. Bilbo, and he wrote poetry. He wrote what I have just said."
"He did not make it up," said Strider. "It's part of the lay that is called the Fall of Gil-galad, which is in an ancient tongue. Bilbo must have translated it. I never knew that."
"There was a lot more," said Sam. "All about Mordor. I didn't learn that part. It gave me the shivers. I never thought I should be going that way myself."
"Going to Mordor?" cried Pippin. "I hope it won't come to that."
"Do not speak that name so loudly," said Strider.
It was already midday when they drew near the southern end of the path, and saw before them, in the pale clear light of the October sun, a grey-green bank, leading up like a bridge onto the northward slope of the hill. They decided to make for the top at once, while the daylight was broad. Concealment was no longer possible, and they could only hope that no enemy or spy was observing them. Nothing was to be seen moving on the hill. If Gandalf was anywhere about, there was no sign of him. On the western flank of Weathertop, they found a sheltered hollow, at the bottom of which there was a bowl-shaped dell with grassy sides.
There they left Sam and Pippin with the pony and their packs and luggage. The other three went on. After half an hour's plodding climb, Strider reached the crown of the hill. Frodo and Merry followed, tired and breathless. The last slope had been steep and rocky. On the top they found, as Strider had said, a wide ring of ancient stonework, now crumbling or covered with age-long grass. But in the centre a cairn of broken stones had been piled. They were blackened, as if with fire. About them the turf was burned to the roots, and all within the ring the grass was scorched and shrivelled, as if flames had swept the hilltop. But there was no sign of any living thing. Standing upon the rim of the ruined circle, they saw all round below them a wide prospect, for the most part of lands empty and featureless, except for patches of woodland away to the south, beyond which they caught here and there the glint of distant water. Beneath them on this southern side there ran like a ribbon the old road, coming out of the west and winding up and down, until it faded behind a ridge of dark land to the east. Nothing was moving on it. Following its line eastward with their eyes, they saw the mountains. The nearer foothills were brown and sombre. Behind them stood taller shapes of grey, and behind those again were high white peaks glimmering among the clouds.
"Well, here we are," said Merry, "and very cheerless and uninviting it looks. There is no water and no shelter, and no sign of Gandalf. But I don't blame him for not waiting, if he ever came here."
"I wonder," said Strider, looking round thoughtfully. "Even if he was a day or two behind us at Bree, he could have arrived here first. He can ride very swiftly when need presses." Suddenly he stooped and looked at the stone on the top of the cairn. It was flatter than the others, and whiter, as if it had escaped the fire. He picked it up and examined it, turning it in his fingers.
"This has been handled recently," he said. "What do you think of those marks?"
On the flat underside, Frodo saw some scratches.
"There seems to be a stroke, a dot, and three more strokes," he said.
"The stroke on the left might be a G-rune with thin branches," said Strider. "It might be a sign left by Gandalf, though one cannot be sure. The scratches are fine, and they certainly look fresh. But the marks might mean something quite different, and have nothing to do with us. Rangers use runes, and they come here sometimes."
"What could they mean, even if Gandalf made them?"
asked Merry.
"I should say," answered Strider, "that they stood for G3, and were a sign that Gandalf was here on October the 3rd, that is, 3 days ago now. It would also show that he was in a hurry, and danger was at hand, so that he had no time or did not dare to write anything longer or plainer. If that is so, we must be wary."
"I wish we could feel sure that he made the marks, whatever they may mean," said Frodo. "It would be a great comfort to know that he was on the way, in front of us or behind us."
"Perhaps," said Strider. "For myself, I believe that he was here and was in danger. There have been scorching flames here, and now the light that we saw 3 nights ago in the eastern sky comes back to my mind. I guess that he was attacked on this hilltop, but with what result I cannot tell. He is here no longer, and we must now look after ourselves and make our own way to Rivendell as best we can."
"How far is Rivendell?" asked Merry, gazing round wearily.
The world looked wild and wide from Weathertop.
"I don't know if the road has ever been measured in miles beyond the Forsaken Inn, a day's journey east of Bree," answered Strider. "Some say it is so far, and some say otherwise. It's a strange road, and folk are glad to reach their journey's end, whether the time is long or short. But I know not how long it would take me on my own feet, with fair weather and no ill fortune. 12 days from here to the ford of Bruinen, where the road crosses the loud water that runs out of Rivendell. We have at least a fortnight's journey before us, for I do not think we shall be able to use the road."
"A fortnight," said Frodo. "A lot may happen in that time."
"It may," said Strider.
They stood for a while silent on the hilltop, near its southward edge. In that lonely place Frodo for the first time fully realized his homelessness and danger. He wished bitterly that his fortune had left him in the quiet and beloved Shire. He stared down at the hateful road, leading back westward to his home. Suddenly he was aware that two black specks were moving slowly along it, going westward. And looking again, he saw that three others were creeping eastward to meet them. He gave a cry and clutched Strider's arm. "Look," he said, pointing downwards. At once Strider flung himself on the ground behind the ruined circle, pulling Frodo down beside him. Merry threw himself alongside.
"What is it?" he whispered.
"I don't know, but I fear the worst," answered Strider. Slowly they crawled up to the edge of the ring again and peered through a cleft between two jagged stones. The light was no longer bright, for the clear morning had faded, and clouds creeping out of the east had now overtaken the sun as it began to go down. They could all see the black specks, but neither Frodo nor Merry could make out their shapes for certain. Yet something told them that there, far below, were black riders assembling on the road beyond the foot of the hill.
"Yes,"
said Strider, whose keenest sight left them in no doubt. "The enemy is here." Hastily they crept away and slipped down the north side of the hill to find their companions. Sam and Peregrine had not been idle. They had explored the small dell and the surrounding slopes. Not far away they found a spring of clear water in the hillside, and near it footprints not more than a day or two old. In the dell itself they found recent traces of a fire and other signs of a hasty camp. There were some fallen rocks on the edge of the dell nearest to the hill. Behind them Sam came upon a small store of firewood, neatly stacked.
"I wonder if old Gandalf has been here," he said to Pippin. "Whoever it was put this stuff here meant to come back, it seems."
Strider was greatly interested in these discoveries.
"I wish I had waited and explored the ground down here myself," he said, hurrying off to the spring to examine the footprints. "It's just as I feared," he said when he came back. "Sam and Pippin have trampled the soft ground, and the marks are spoiled or confused. Rangers have been here lately. It is they who left the firewood behind. But there are also several newer tracks that were not made by rangers. At least one set was made only a day or two ago by heavy boots. At least one. I cannot now be certain, but I think there were many booted feet." He paused and stood in anxious thought. Each of the hobbits saw in his mind a vision of the cloaked and booted riders. If the horsemen had already found the dell, the sooner Strider led them somewhere else the better. Sam viewed the hollow with great dislike, now that he had heard news of their enemies on the road, only a few miles away.
"Hadn't we better clear out quick, Mr. Strider?" he asked impatiently. "It's getting late, and I don't like this hole. It makes my heart sink somehow."
"Yes, we certainly must decide what to do at once," answered Strider, looking up and considering the time and the weather. "Well, Sam," he said at last, "I don't like this place either, but I can't think of anywhere better that we could reach before nightfall.
At least we are out of sight for the moment, and if we moved, we should be much more likely to be seen by spies. All we could do would be to go right out of our way back north on this side of the line of hills, where the land is all much the same as it is here. The road is watched, but we should have to cross it if we tried to take cover in the thickets away to the south. On the north side of the road beyond the hills, the country is bare and flat for miles."
"Can the riders see?" asked Merry. "I mean, they seem usually to have used their noses rather than their eyes, smelling for us, if smelling is the right word, at least in the daylight.
But you made us lie down flat when you saw them down below, and now you talk of being seen if we move."
"I was too careless on the hilltop," answered Strider. "I was very anxious to find some sign of Gandalf, but it was a mistake for three of us to go up and stand there so long. For the black horses can see, and the riders can use men and other creatures as spies, as we found at Bree. They themselves do not see the world of light as we do, but our shapes cast shadows in their minds, which only the noon sun destroys, and in the dark they perceive many signs and forms that are hidden from us. Then they are most to be feared, and at all times they smell the blood of living things, desiring and hating it. Senses, too, there are other than sight or smell. We can feel their presence. It troubled our hearts. As soon as we came here, and before we saw them, they feel ours more keenly. Also, he added, and his voice sank to a whisper, the ring draws them near.
Is there no escape, then? Said Frodo, looking round wildly. If I move, I shall be seen and hunted. If I stay, I shall draw them to me.
Strider laid his hand on his shoulder.
There is still hope, he said. You are not alone. Let us take this wood that is set ready for the fire as a sign. There is little shelter or defence here, but fire shall serve for both. Sauron can put fire to his evil uses, as he can all things, but these riders do not love it, and fear those who wield it. Fire is our friend in the wilderness.
Maybe, muttered Sam. It's also as good a way of saying, here we are, as I can think of, bar shouting. Down in the lowest and most sheltered corner of the dell they lit a fire, and prepared a meal. The shades of evening began to fall, and it grew cold. They were suddenly aware of great hunger, for they had not eaten anything since breakfast, but they dared not make more than a frugal supper. The lands ahead were empty of all save birds and beasts, unfriendly places deserted by all the races of the world. Rangers passed at times beyond the hills, but they were few and did not stay. Other wanderers were rare and of evil sorts. Trolls might stray down at times out of the northern valleys of the misty mountains. Only on the road would travellers be found, most often dwarves, hurrying along on business of their own, and with no help and few words to spare for strangers.
"I don't see how our food can be made to last," said Frodo. "We've been careful enough in the last few days, and this supper's no feast. But we've used more than we ought, if we have 2 weeks still to go, and perhaps more."
"There is food in the wild," said Strider, "berry, root, and herb, and I have some skill as a hunter at need. You need not be afraid of starving before winter comes, but gathering and catching food is long and weary work, and we need haste. So tighten your belts, and think with hope of the tables of Elrond's house."
The cold increased as darkness came on. Peering out from the edge of the dell, they could see nothing but a grey land now vanishing quickly into shadow. The sky above had cleared again, and was slowly filled with twinkling stars. Frodo and his companions huddled round the fire, wrapped in every garment and blanket they possessed, but Strider was content with a single cloak, and sat a little apart, drawing thoughtfully at his pipe. As night fell, and the light of the fire began to shine out brightly, he began to tell them tales to keep their minds from fear. He knew many histories and legends of long ago, of elves and men and the good and evil deeds of the elder days. They wondered how old he was, and where he had learned all this lore.
"Tell us of Kil-galad," said Merry suddenly,
when he paused at the end of a story of the elf kingdoms.
"Do you know any more of that old lay that you spoke of?"
"I do indeed," answered Strider. "So also does Frodo, for it concerns us closely."
Merry and Pippin looked at Frodo, who was staring into the fire.
"I know only the little that Gandalf has told me," said Frodo slowly.
"Gil-galad was the last of the great elf kings of Middle-earth. Gil-galad is starlight in their tongue. With Elendil, the elf friend, he went to the land of—"
"No," said Strider, interrupting. "I don't think that tale should be told now with the servants of the enemy at hand. If we win through to the house of Elrond, you may hear it there, told in full."
"Then tell us some other tale of the old days," begged Sam. "A tale about the elves before the fading time. I would dearly like to hear more about elves. The dark seems to press round so close."
"I will tell you the tale of Tenuvial," said Strider. in brief, for it's a long tale of which the end is not known, and there are none now, except Elrond, that remember it aright as it was told of old. It is a fair tale, though it's sad, as are all the tales of Middle-earth, and yet it may lift up your hearts." He was silent for some time, and then he began not to speak, but to chant softly. The leaves were long, the grass was green, the hemlock umbels tall and fair, and in the glade a light was seen of stars in shadow shimmering. Tinnoviel was dancing there to music of a pipe unseen, and light of stars was in her hair and in her raiment glimmering. There Beren came from mountains cold, and lost he wandered under leaves, and where the elven river rolled he walked alone and sorrowing. He peered between the hemlock leaves, and saw in wonder flowers of gold upon her mantle and her sleeves, and her hair like shadow following. Enchantment healed his weary feet, that over hills were doomed to roam, and forth he hastened, strong and fleet, and grasped at moonbeams glistening. Through woven woods in elven home she lightly fled on dancing feet, and left him lonely still to roam in the silent forests listening. He heard there oft the flying sound of feet as light as linden leaves, or music welling underground in hidden hollows quavering. Now withered lay the hemlock sheaves, and one by one with sighing sound, whispering fell the beechen leaves in the wintry woodland wavering. He sought her ever, wandering far, where leaves of years were thickly strewn, by light of moon and ray of star, in frosty heavens shivering. Her mantle glinted in the moon, as on a hilltop high and far she danced, and at her feet was strewn a mist of silver quivering. When winter passed, she came again, and her song released the sudden spring, like rising lark and falling rain, and melting water bubbling. He saw the elven flowers spring about her feet, and healed again he longed by her to dance and sing upon the grass untroubling. Again she fled, but swift he came. "Tinnoviel, Tinnoviel," he called her by her elvish name, and there she halted, listening. One moment stood she, and a spell his voice laid on her. Beren came, and doom fell on Tinnoviel, that in his arms lay glistening. As Beren looked into her eyes, within the shadows of her hair, the trembling starlight of the skies, he saw their mirrored shimmering. Tinnoviel, the elven fair, immortal maiden elven wise, about him cast her shadowy hair and arms like silver glimmering. Long was the way that fate them bore, o'er stony mountains cold and grey, through halls of iron and darkling door, and woods of nightshade morrowless. The sundering seas between them lay, and yet at last they met once more, and long ago they passed away in the forest singing sorrowless. Strider sighed and paused before he spoke again. "That is a song," he said, "in the mode that is called Anthenath among the elves, but is hard to render in our common speech, and this is but a rough echo of it. It tells of the meeting of Beren, son of Barahir, and Luthien Tinnoviel. Beren was a mortal man, but Luthien was the daughter of Thingol, a king of elves upon Middle-earth when the world was young, and she was the fairest maiden that has ever been among all the children of this world. As the stars above the mists of the northern lands was her loveliness, and in her face was a shining light. In those days the great enemy, of whom Sauron of Mordor was but a servant, dwelt in Angband in the north, and the elves of the west, coming back to Middle-earth, made war upon him to regain the Silmarils, which he had stolen, and the fathers of men aided the elves. But the enemy was victorious, and Barahir was slain, and Beren, escaping through great peril, came over the mountains of terror into the hidden kingdom of Thingol in the forest of Neldoreth.
There he beheld Lothian singing and dancing in a glade beside the enchanted river Esgaldwin. And he named her Tenuviel, that is Nightingale in the language of old. Many sorrows befell them afterwards, and they were parted long. Tenuviel rescued Beren from the dungeons of Sauron, and together they passed through great dangers, and cast down even the great enemy from his throne, and took from his iron crown one of the three Silmarils, brightest of all jewels, to be the bride price of Lúthien to Thingol her father. Yet at the last Beren was slain by the wolf that came from the gates of Angband, and he died in the arms of Tenuviel. But she chose mortality, and to die from the world, so that she might follow him, and it is sung that they met again beyond the sundering seas, and after a brief time walking alive once more in the green woods, together they passed, long ago, beyond the confines of this world. So it is that Lúthien Tenuviel, alone of the elf kindred, has died indeed and left the world, and they have lost her whom they most loved. But from her the lineage of the elf lords of old descended among men. There live still those of whom Lúthien was the foremother, and it is said that her line shall never fail. Elrond of Rivendell is of that kin, for of Beren and Lúthien was born Dior Thingol's heir, and of him Elwing the White, whom Erendil wedded, he that sailed his ship out of the mists of the world into the seas of heaven with a Silmaril upon his brow. And of Erendil came the kings of Númenor, that is Westerness. As Strider was speaking, they watched his strange, eager face, dimly lit in the red glow of the wood-fire. His eyes shone, and his voice was rich and deep. Above him was a black, starry sky. Suddenly a pale light appeared over the crown of Weathertop behind him. The waxing moon was climbing slowly above the hill that overshadowed them, and the stars above the hilltop faded. The story ended. The hobbits moved and stretched. "Look," said Merry, "the moon is rising. It must be getting late." The others looked up. Even as they did so, they saw on the top of the hill something small and dark against the glimmer of the moonrise. It was perhaps only a large stone or jutting rock shown up by the pale light. Sam and Merry got up and walked away from the fire. Frodo and Pippin remained seated in silence. Strider was watching the moonlight on the hill intently. All seemed quiet and still, but Frodo felt a cold dread creeping over his heart, now that Strider was no longer speaking. He huddled closer to the fire. At that moment Sam came running back from the edge of the dell.
"I don't know what it is," he said, "but I suddenly felt afraid. I durstn't go outside this dell for any money. I felt that something was creeping up the slope."
"Did you see anything?" asked Frodo, springing to his feet.
"No, sir, I saw nothing, but I didn't stop to look."
"I saw something," said Merry, "or I thought I did, away westwards, where the moonlight was falling on the flats, beyond the shadow of the hilltops. I thought there were two or three black shapes. They seemed to be moving this way."
"Keep close to the fire, with your faces outward," cried Strider. "Get some of the longer sticks ready in your hands."
For a breathless time they sat there, silent and alert, with their backs turned to the wood fire, each gazing into the shadows that encircled them. Nothing happened. There was no sound or movement in the night. Frodo stirred, feeling that he must break the silence. He longed to shout out aloud.
"Hush!" whispered Strider.
"What's that?" gasped Pippin at the same moment. Over the lip of the little dell, on the side away from the hill, they felt, rather than saw, a shadow rise. One shadow, or more than one. They strained their eyes, and the shadows seemed to grow. Soon there could be no doubt. Three or four tall black figures were standing there on the slope, looking down on them. So black were they that they seemed like black holes in the deep shade behind them. Frodo thought that he heard a faint hiss as a venomous breath, and felt a thin, piercing chill. Then the shape slowly advanced.
Terror overcame Pippin and Merry, and they threw themselves flat on the ground. Sam shrank to Frodo's side. Frodo was hardly less terrified than his companions. He was quaking, as if he was bitter cold, but his terror was swallowed up in a sudden temptation to put on the ring. The desire to do this laid hold of him, and he could think of nothing else. He did not forget the barrow, nor the message of Gandalf, but something seemed to be compelling him to disregard all warnings, and he longed to yield. Not with a hope of escape, or of doing anything, either good or bad, he simply felt that he must take the ring and put it on his finger. He could not speak. He felt Sam looking at him, as if he knew that his master was in some great trouble, but he could not turn towards him. He shut his eyes and struggled for a while, but resistance became unbearable, and at last he slowly drew out the chain and slipped the ring on the forefinger of his left hand. Immediately, though everything else remained as before, dim and dark, the shapes became terribly clear. He was able to see beneath their black wrappings. There were five tall figures, two standing on the lip of the dell, three advancing. In their white faces burned keen and merciless eyes. Under their mantles were long grey robes. Upon their grey hairs were helms of silver. In their haggard hands were swords of steel. Their eyes fell on him and pierced him as they rushed towards him. Desperate, he drew his own sword, and it seemed to him that it flickered red, as if it was a firebrand. Two of the figures halted. The third was taller than the others. His hair was long and gleaming, and on his helm was a crown. In one hand he held a long sword, and in the other a knife. Both the knife and the hand that held it glowed with a pale light. He sprang forward and bore down on Frodo. At that moment, Frodo threw himself forward on the ground, and he heard himself crying aloud, "O Elbereth, Gilthoniel!" At the same time he struck at the feet of his enemy. A shrill cry rang out in the night, and he felt a pain like a dart of poisoned ice pierce his left shoulder. Even as he swooned, he caught, as through a swirling mist, a glimpse of Strider leaping out of the darkness with a flaming brand of wood in either hand. With a last effort, Frodo, dropping his sword, slipped the ring from his finger and closed his right hand tight upon it. Chapter 12. Flight to the Ford. When Frodo came to himself, he was still clutching the ring desperately. He was lying by the fire, which was now piled high and burning brightly. His three companions were bending over him. "What has happened? Where is the Pale King?" he asked wildly. They were too overjoyed to hear him speak to answer for a while, nor did they understand his question. At length he gathered from Sam that they'd seen nothing but the vague, shadowy shapes coming towards them. Suddenly, to his horror, Sam found that his master had vanished, and at that moment a black shadow rushed past him, and he fell. He heard Frodo's voice, but it seemed to come from a great distance, or from under the earth, crying out strange words. They saw nothing more until they stumbled over the body of Frodo, lying as if dead, face downwards on the grass with his sword beneath him. Strider ordered them to pick him up and lay him near the fire, and then he disappeared. That was now a good while ago. Sam plainly was beginning to have doubts again about Strider. But while they were talking he returned, appearing suddenly out of the shadows. They started, and Sam drew his sword and stood over Frodo, but Strider knelt down swiftly at his side.
"I'm not a Black Rider, Sam," he said gently, "nor in league with them. I've been trying to discover something of their movements, but I've found nothing. I can't think why they've gone and don't attack again, but there is no feeling of their presence anywhere at hand."
When he heard what Frodo had to tell, he became full of concern and shook his head and sighed. Then he ordered Pippin and Merry to heat as much water as they could in their small kettles, and to bathe the wound with it.
"Keep the fire going well, and keep Frodo warm," he said.
Then he got up and walked away, and called Sam to him.
"I think I understand things better now," he said in a low voice. There seem only to have been 5 of the enemy. Why they were not all here, I don't know, but I don't think they expected to be resisted. They've drawn off for a time being, but not far, I fear. They'll come back again another night if we can't escape. But they're only waiting because they think that their purpose is almost accomplished and that the ring cannot fly much further. I fear, Sam, that they believe your master has a deadly wound that will subdue him to their will. We shall see. Sam choked with tears. Don't despair, said Strider. You must trust me now. Your Frodo is made of sterner stuff than I had guessed, though Gandalf hinted that it might prove so. He's not slain, and I think he'll resist the evil power of the wound longer than his enemies expect. I'll do all I can to help and heal him, guard him well while I'm away. He hurried off and disappeared again into the darkness. Frodo dozed, though the pain of his wound was slowly growing, and a deadly chill was spreading from his shoulder to his arm and side. His friends watched over him, warming him and bathing his wound. The night passed slowly and wearily. Dawn was growing in the sky, and the dell was filling with grey light, when Strider at last returned. "Look!" he cried. And stooping, he lifted from the ground a black cloak that had lain there hidden by the darkness. A foot above the lower hem there was a slash. "This was the stroke of Frodo's sword," he said. "The only hurt that it did to his enemy, I fear, for it is unharmed. But all blades perish that pierce that dreadful king. More deadly to him was the name of Elbereth. And more deadly to Frodo was this." He stooped again and lifted up a long, thin knife. There was a cold gleam in it. As Strider raised it, they saw that near the end its edge was notched and the point was broken off. But even as he held it up in the growing light, they gazed in astonishment, for the blade seemed to melt and vanished like smoke in the air, leaving only the hilt in Strider's hand.
"Alas!" he cried. "It was this accursed knife that gave the wound. Few now have the skill in healing to match such evil weapons, but I'll do what I can."
He sat down on the ground, and taking the dagger hilt, laid it on his knees, and he sang over it a slow song in a strange tongue. Then, setting it aside, he turned to Frodo, and in a soft tone spoke words the others couldn't catch. From the pouch at his belt he drew out the long leaves of a plant.
"These leaves," he said, "I have walked far to find, for this plant does not grow in the bare hills, but in the thickets away south of the road. I found it in the dark by the scent of its leaves." He crushed a leaf in his fingers, and it gave out a sweet and pungent fragrance. "It is fortunate that I could find it, for it's a healing plant that the men of the West brought to Middle-earth. Athelus they named it, and it grows now sparsely, and only near places where they dwelt or camped of old, and it is not known in the North except to some of those who wander in the wild. It has great virtues, but over such a wound as this its healing powers may be small." He threw the leaves into boiling water and bathed Frodo's shoulder. The fragrance of the steam was refreshing, and those that were unhurt felt their minds calmed and cleared. The herb had also some power over the wound, for Frodo felt the pain and also the sense of frozen cold lessen in his side. But the life did not return to his arm, and he could not raise or use his hand. He bitterly regretted his foolishness, and reproached himself for weakness of will, for he now perceived that in putting on the ring he obeyed not his own desire, but the commanding wish of his enemies. He wondered if he would remain maimed for life, and how they would now manage to continue their journey. He felt too weak to stand. The others were discussing this very question. They quickly decided to leave Weathertop as soon as possible. "I think now," said Strider, "that the enemy has been watching this place for some days. If Gandalf ever came here, then he must have been forced to ride away, and he will not return. In any case, we are in great peril here after dark, since the attack of last night, and we can hardly meet greater danger wherever we go." As soon as the daylight was full, they had some hurried food and packed. It was impossible for Frodo to walk, so they divided the greater part of their baggage among the four of them and put Frodo on the pony. In the last few days the poor beast had improved wonderfully. It already seemed fatter and stronger, and had begun to show an affection for its new masters, especially for Sam. Bill Ferney's treatment must have been very hard for the journey in the wild to seem so much better than its former life. They started off in a southerly direction. This would mean crossing the road, but it was the quickest way to more wooded country. And they needed fuel, for Strider said that Frodo must be kept warm, especially at night, while fire would be some protection for them all. It was also his plan to shorten their journey by cutting across another great loop of the road. East beyond Weathertop it changed its course and took a wide bend northwards. They made their way slowly and cautiously round the southwestern slopes of the hill, and came in a little while to the edge of the road. There was no sign of the riders, but even as they were hurrying across, they heard far away two cries, a cold voice calling and a cold voice answering. Trembling, they sprang forward and made for the thickets that lay ahead. The land before them sloped away southwards, but it was wild and pathless. Bushes and stunted trees grew in dense patches, with wide barren spaces in between. The grass was scanty, coarse and grey, and the leaves in the thickets were faded and falling. It was a cheerless land, and their journey was slow and gloomy. They spoke little as they trudged along. Frodo's heart was grieved as he watched them walking beside him with their heads down, and their backs bowed under their burdens. Even Strider seemed tired and heavy-hearted. Before the first day's march was over, Frodo's pain began to grow again, but he did not speak of it for a long time. 4 days passed, without the ground or the scene changing much, except that behind them Weathertop slowly sank, and before them the distant mountains loomed a little nearer. Yet since that far cry, they had seen and heard no sign that the enemy had marked their flight or followed them. They dreaded the dark hours, and kept watch in pairs by night, expecting at any time to see black shapes stalking in the grey night, dimly lit by the cloud-veiled moon. But they saw nothing, and heard no sound but the sigh of withered leaves and grass. Not once did they feel the sense of present evil that had assailed them before the attack in the dell. It seemed too much to hope that the riders had already lost their trail again. Perhaps they were waiting to make some ambush in a narrow place. At the end of the 5th day the ground began once more to rise slowly out of the wide shadow valley into which they had descended. Strider now turned their course again northeastwards, and on the 6th day they reached the top of a long, slow-climbing slope, and saw far ahead a huddle of wooded hills. Away below them they could see the road sweeping round the feet of the hills, and to their right a grey river gleamed pale in the thin sunshine. In the distance they glimpsed yet another river in a stony valley half-veiled in mist.
"I'm afraid we must go back to the road here for a while," said Strider. "We have now come to the river Horwell that the elves call Mithaethel. It flows down over the Etten Moors, the Trollfells north of Rivendell, and joins the Loudwater away in the south. Some call it the Grey Flood after that. It's a great water before it finds the sea. There's no way over it below its sources in the Etten Moors, except by the last bridge on which the road crosses."
"What is that other river we can see far away there?" asked Merry.
"That is Loudwater, the Bruinen of Rivendell," answered Strider. "The road runs along the edge of the hills for many miles from the bridge to the ford of Bruinen. But I have not yet thought how we shall cross the water, one river at a time. We shall be fortunate indeed if we don't find the last bridge held against us."
Next day, early in the morning, they came down again to the borders of the road.
Sam and Strider went forward, but they found no sign of any travellers or riders. Here, under the shadow of the hills, there had been some rain. Strider judged that it had fallen 2 days before and had washed away all footprints. No horseman had passed since then, as far as he could see. They hurried along with all the speed they could make, and after a mile or two they saw the last bridge ahead, at the bottom of a short, steep slope. They dreaded to see black figures waiting there, but they saw none. Strider made them take cover in a thicket at the side of the road, while he went forward to explore. Before long he came hurrying back. "I can see no signs of the enemy," he said, "and I wonder very much what that means. But I found something very strange." He held out his hand and showed a single pale green jewel. "I found it in the mud in the middle of the bridge," he said. "It is a beryl, an elf stone. Whether it was set there or let fall by chance, I can't say, but it brings hope to me. I'll take it as a sign that we may pass the bridge, but beyond that I dare not keep to the road without some clearer token." At once they went on again. They crossed the bridge in safety, hearing no sound but the water swirling against its three great arches. A mile further on they came to a narrow ravine that led away northwards through the steep lands on the left of the road. Here Strider turned aside, and soon they were lost in a sombre country of dark trees winding among the feet of sullen hills. The hobbits were glad to leave the cheerless lands and the perilous road behind them, but this new country seemed threatening and unfriendly. As they went forward, the hills about them steadily rose. Here and there, upon heights and ridges, they caught glimpses of ancient walls of stone and the ruins of towers. They had an ominous look. Frodo, who was not walking, had time to gaze ahead and to think. He recalled Bilbo's account of his journey and the threatening towers on the hills north of the road, in the country near the Troll's Wood, where his first serious adventure had happened. Frodo guessed that they were now in the same region, and wondered if by chance they would pass near the spot. "Who lives in this land?" he asked. "And who built these towers? Is this troll country?"
"No," said Strider. "Trolls do not build. No one lives in this land. Men once dwelt here, ages ago, but none remain now. They became an evil people, as legends tell, for they fell under the shadow of Angmar. But all were destroyed in the war that brought the North Kingdom to its end. But that is now so long ago that the hills have forgotten them, though a shadow still lies on the land."
"Where did you learn such tales, if all the land is empty and forgetful?" asked Peregrine. "The birds and beasts don't tell tales of that sort."
"The heirs of Elendil do not forget all these things," said Strider, "and many more things than I can tell are remembered in Rivendell."
"Have you often been to Rivendell?" asked Frodo.
"I have," said Strider. "I dwelt there once, and still I return when I may. There my heart is. But it is not my fate to sit in peace, even in the fair house of Elrond."
The hills now began to shut them in. The road behind held on its way to the river Bruinen, but both were now hidden from view. The travellers came into a long valley, narrow, deeply cloven, dark and silent. Trees with old and twisted roots hung over cliffs and piled up behind into mounting slopes of pine wood. The hobbits grew very weary. They advanced slowly, for they had to pick their way through a pathless country, encumbered by fallen trees and tumbled rocks. As long as they could, they avoided climbing for Frodo's sake, and because it was in fact difficult to find any way up out of the narrow dales. They had been 2 days in this country when the weather turned wet. The wind began to blow steadily out of the west and pour the water of the distant seas on the dark heads of the hills in fine drenching rain. By nightfall they were all soaked, and their camp was cheerless, for they could not get any fire to burn. The next day the hills rose still higher and steeper before them, and they were forced to turn away northwards out of their course. Strider seemed to be getting anxious. They were nearly 10 days out from Weathertop, and their stock of provisions was beginning to run low. It went on raining. That night they camped on a stony shelf, with a rock wall behind them, in which there was a shallow cave, a mere scoop in the cliff. Frodo was restless. The cold and wet had made his wound more painful than ever, and the ache and sense of deadly chill took away all sleep. He lay tossing and turning and listening fearfully to the stealthy night noises. Wind in chinks of rock, water dripping, a crack, the sudden rattling fall of a loosened stone. He felt that black shapes were advancing to smother him, but when he sat up he saw nothing but the back of Strider, sitting hunched up, smoking his pipe, and watching. He lay down again and passed into an uneasy dream, in which he walked on the grass in his garden in the Shire, but it seemed faint and dim, less clear than the tall black shadows that stood looking over the hedge. In the morning he woke to find that the rain had stopped. The clouds were still thick, but they were breaking, and pale strips of blue appeared between them. The wind was shifting again. They didn't start early. Immediately after their cold and comfortless breakfast, Strider went off alone, telling the others to remain under the shelter of the cliff until he came back. He was going to climb up, if he could, and get a look at the lie of the land. When he returned, he wasn't reassuring. "We've come too far to the north," he said, "and we must find some way to turn back southwards again. If we keep on as we are going, we shall get up into the Ettendales far north of Rivendell. That is troll country, and little known to me. We could perhaps find our way through and come round to Rivendell from the north, but it would take too long, for I don't know the way, and our food would not last. So somehow or other we must find the ford of Bruinen." The rest of that day they spent scrambling over rocky ground. They found a passage between two hills that led them into a valley running southeast, the direction that they wished to take. But towards the end of the day they found their road again barred by a ridge of high land. Its dark edge against the sky was broken into many bare points, like teeth of a blunted saw. They had a choice between going back or climbing over it. They decided to attempt the climb, but it proved very difficult. Before long Frodo was obliged to dismount and struggle along on foot. Even so, they often despaired of getting their pony up, or indeed of finding a path for themselves, burdened as they were. The light was nearly gone, and they were all exhausted when at last they reached the top. They had climbed on to a narrow saddle between two higher points, and the land fell steeply away again, only a short distance ahead. Frodo threw himself down and lay on the ground shivering. His left arm was lifeless, and his side and shoulder felt as if icy claws were laid upon them. The trees and rocks about him seemed shadowy and dim.
"We can't go any further," said Merry to Strider. "I'm afraid this has been too much for Frodo. I'm dreadfully anxious about him. What are we to do? Do you think they'll be able to cure him in Rivendell if we ever get there?"
"We shall see," answered Strider. "There is nothing more that I can do in the wilderness, and it's chiefly because of his wound that I'm so anxious to press on. But I agree that we can go no further tonight."
"What's the matter with my master?" asked Sam in a low voice, looking appealingly at Strider. "His wound was small, and it's already closed. There is nothing to be seen but a cold white mark on his shoulder."
"Frodo has been touched by the weapons of the enemy," said Strider, "and there is some poison or evil at work that's beyond my skill to drive out. But don't give up hope, Sam." Night was cold up on the high ridge. They lit a small fire down under the gnarled roots of an old pine that hung over a shallow pit. It looked as if stone had once been quarried there. They sat huddled together. The wind blew chill through the pass, and they heard the treetops lower down moaning and sighing. Frodo lay half in a dream, imagining that endless dark wings were sweeping by above him, and that on the wings rode pursuers that sought him in all the hollows of the hills. The morning dawned bright and fair, The air was clean, and the light pale and clear in a rain-washed sky. Their hearts were encouraged, but they longed for the sun to warm their cold, stiff limbs. As soon as it was light, Strider took Mary with him and went to survey the country from the height to the east of the pass. The sun had risen and was shining brightly when he returned with more comforting news. They were now going more or less in the right direction. If they went on, down the further side of the ridge, they would have the mountains on the left. Some way ahead, Strider had caught a glimpse of the Loudwater again, and he knew that, though it was hidden from view, the road to the ford was not far from the river, and lay on the side nearest to them.
"We must make for the road again," he said. "We can't hope to find a path through these hills. Whatever danger may beset it, the road is our only way to the ford."
As soon as they had eaten, they set out again. They climbed slowly down the southern side of the ridge, but the way was much easier than they had expected, for the slope was far less steep on this side, and before long Frodo was able to ride again. Bill Ferney's poor old pony was developing an unexpected talent for picking out a path, and for sparing its rider as many jolts as possible. The spirits of the party rose again. Even Frodo felt better in the morning light, but every now and again a mist seemed to obscure his sight, and he passed his hands over his eyes. Pippin was a little ahead of the others. Suddenly he turned round and called to them.
"There's a path here," he cried.
When they came up with him, they saw that he had made no mistake. There were clearly the beginnings of a path that climbed with many windings out of the woods below and faded away on the hilltop behind. In places it was now faint and overgrown, or choked with fallen stones and trees, but at one time it seemed to have been much used. It was a path made by strong arms and heavy feet. Here and there old trees had been cut or broken down, and large rocks cloven or heaved aside to make a way. They followed the track for some while, for it offered much the easiest way down, but they went cautiously, and their anxiety increased as they came into the dark woods, and the path grew plainer and broader. Suddenly, coming out of a belt of fir trees, it ran steeply down a slope, and turned sharply to the left round the corner of a rocky shoulder of the hill. When they came to the corner, they looked round and saw that the path ran on over a level strip under the face of a low cliff overhung with trees. In the stony wall there was a door hanging crookedly ajar upon one great hinge. Outside the door they all halted. There was a cave or rock chamber behind, but in the gloom inside nothing could be seen. Strider, Sam, and Merry, pushing with all their strength, managed to open the door a little wider, and then Strider and Merry went in. They didn't go far, for on the floor lay many old bones, and nothing else was to be seen near the entrance except some great empty jars and broken pots.
"Surely this is a troll hole, if ever there was one," said Pippin. "Come out, you two, and let us get away. Now we know who made the path, and we'd better get off it quick."
"There's no need, I think," said Strider, coming out. "It's certainly a troll hole, but it seems to have been long forsaken. I don't think we need be afraid, but let's go on down warily, and we shall see."
The path went on again from the door, and turning to the right again across the level space, plunged down a thick wooded slope. Pippin, not liking to show Strider that he was still afraid, went on ahead with Merry. Sam and Strider came behind, one on each side of Frodo's pony, for the path was now broad enough for four or five hobbits to walk abreast. But they had not gone very far before Pippin came running back, followed by Merry. They both looked terrified.
"There are trolls," Pippin panted, "down in a clearing in the woods not far below. We got a sight of them through the tree trunks. They're very large."
"We'll come and look at them," said Strider, picking up a stick.
Frodo said nothing, but Sam looked scared. The sun was now high, and it shone down through the half-stripped branches of the trees and lit the clearing with bright patches of light. They halted suddenly on the edge, and peered through the tree trunks,